morning, Jackie.
Hi, Mark.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Ready to go.
Ready to go. Well, we've got limited time and a bunch of topics, so I'm just going to dive right in. We're going to start
Let's talk about something you know something
I'm
about.
There are very few things.
A tradition very rarely honored on Blogging Heads. We're going to note later that that some of our predecessors managed to have a whole conversation about Harry Potter and the Sopranos.
Yeah, shockingly.
Despite never having watched or read
exactly. It was funny.
We're going to turn that around.
Iran and North Korea. There's this sort of a good news, bad news situation. North Korea has made good on its promises to shut down its 5-megawatt reactor at Yongbyon and a series of other facilities for fabricating fuel or for reprocessing plutonium. So those facilities have all been, in varying ways, mothballed and are now under IAEA supervision. Now the hard part comes where North Korea has to come forward and give to the other members of the six party, the six parties involved in this diplomatic effort with them, give them the goods. Say how much plutonium they have, how many weapons they have, and this is kind of going to be the interesting part of this process. Seeing how many roadblocks along the way there are to North Korea disclosing this information. This is really where the North Korean leadership is going to have to take a deep breath and dive in to this agreement. There are a lot of expert analyses of how much plutonium North Korea could have, including I think a good one done by my colleagues at ISIS, David Albright and Paul Brannan, and they assess, looking at how North Korea's reactor has operated on and off over the last 10 years, they assess that North Korea could have separated between 46 and 64 kilograms of plutonium, which would be enough for between 5 and 12 weapons.
Now, was this sort of, do you think this is this a diplomatic triumph, or was this sort of the plan all along? Build a few weapons so we have them, we'll always have them, and then we'll declare ourselves good citizens.
Well, it's hard to say what North Korea's plan is, whether they've had a plan all along or they're punting or making it up as they go along, but really what this does is bring us back to the status quo ante. We're now sort of back to 1994, 1995, the first months of the agreed framework. But the downside of that is that in the interim between 94 and now, 12 years, North Korea has separated the majority of the plutonium that North Korea could have, is believed to have, or could have in its stockpile. It has separated since the agreed framework. So there's no real success that the Bush administration can claim. Although it is a good thing, certainly, that the diplomacy has won the day, and the reactors shut down, and the IAEA is back in there. I mean, this is the first step on a long road to persuading North Korea to rejoin the NPT and just sort of the community of nations of non-proliferation norms. The bad news, of course, is Iran, where things really continue to be stalemated. It looks like over the last month or so, there's been a slowdown in the pace of centrifuge installation work at Natanz. The last we knew for sure, we believed Iran had between 1,600 and 2,000 centrifuges operating. Their goal was to have about 3,000 centrifuges spinning by this time. Mm-hmm. And that date has slipped a little bit even since May when they had initially planned on having the first 3,000 installed. We're going to find out more in mid-August when the IAEA next reports to the Board of Governors whether Iran has finalized installation of what is known as a module of a big block of centrifuges, 18 cascades of 164 centrifuges each. That is going to be a significant achievement for Iran. Of course, they can install those centrifuges. How well they're running is another matter entirely, and from the limited data we have available, it looks like their centrifuges are not really running at peak efficiency or capacity, are somewhere maybe at the midpoint. So there's still a lot we have to learn about what exactly Iran has achieved. But that's definitely not a good news story.
Right. What's the current thinking about the politics of Iran?
Yeah, that's also been a disappointment.
About the nuclear issue. I mean, it seemed to me that a while back it was more of a, it could kind of go either way.
Well, it now looks like there's no momentum in the Security Council, among Security Council members, for another resolution until September at the earliest. There had initially been talk of an August resolution. It's very hard to get the Security Council to do much in August unless there's a real kind of pressing international crisis. So it's going to be September before there could be a third sanctions resolution, and then will China go along? Maybe, maybe not. That's a problem for the United States, Britain, and France, which really want to push hard to sanction Iran again. The one other development that there's been in the last couple of weeks is Iran's been in talks with the IAEA over resolving these quote-unquote outstanding issues. And they've said to the IAEA that inspectors are now welcome to come visit the heavy water reactor at Arak. That's A-R-A-K. It was always a very unsustainable position that Iran would try to prevent the IAEA from visiting this facility. The IAEA had full grounds on which to make safeguards visits, and Iran was trying to read the fine print of a very old and outdated clause in its safeguards agreement dating back to the 70s. So it didn't really have a lot of ground to stand on there. Now they've said to the IAEA, you can come visit this facility. That's sort of the small piece of good news that there is. And they've also agreed, I think, to try to resolve some outstanding questions about their plutonium experiments. The hard outstanding questions, the big things, still remain. And these are things that have to do with documents in Iran's possession about working with uranium metal, which could indicate research into weaponization techniques. So anyway, the big hard outstanding questions remain, and overall, it doesn't look like it's a good summer for either diplomacy or persuading Iran to stand down its enrichment efforts.
Can I ask a totally naive question? Like, why is it that North Korea is the totally isolated, backward country? Has been able to build weapons, and Iran, which has been it's a modern industrial country with relations, all kinds of commercial relations with the West and Europe and so forth, actually is so much farther away.
Wait. Like, Iran has said it doesn't intend to build weapons. And Iran, as far as we know, there are lots of red flags. There are things that give people concern that they could have a parallel program, they could be hiding something. But don't mistake their lack of speed for acquiring a weapon for some kind of indication of technological... Well, as you say, it's not a technologically backward country, very much the opposite.
Right.
But Iran is saying that, it has no intention to seek a nuclear weapon.
Right.
And... You wouldn't expect to see if you're taking Iran at its word, that's not their plan.
Right. But I've seen other things that said, they're 5 years away, and I presume that's a technological assessment.
Yeah, well, that's crunching the numbers about how many centrifuges could they build and how much HEU could it produce and yada, yada, yada. And all those numbers are so fuzzy, and they're all based on so many hypotheticals and so many fuzzy variables. I avoid those things. And people always want to ask, how far away are they from a bomb? It's kind of a pointless question. I understand why people want to know that, but answering it is really meaningless. And the answers that are given are somewhat meaningless. Because if somebody gave Iran a pile of plutonium, they could probably weaponize it pretty quickly if they, worked at it, a couple of months, some good engineers.
Right.
But if they try to, reprocess their own plutonium or enrich their uranium, that's a different story. It takes longer. Iran does not say it seeks a nuclear weapon, just the opposite.
Right, of course. Okay, good. Well, that's good to know. It's kind of like when the doctor says you have 6 months to live. And it doesn't really mean anything,
right. One of the things we wanted to talk about, which I think is really interesting in light of the North Korea-Iran, dual-track approaches of diplomacy, are the Democratic candidates and these questions that they've been asked during debates. Would you talk to Iran? Would you talk to North Korea?
And
how controversial their answers are getting. So you had some thoughts about that.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I mean... you know, the question was, and I reread it yesterday, the literal question at the CNN YouTube debate was, you know, would you meet, as president, would you meet without preconditions with the leaders of Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, and Cuba? And Barack Obama answered the question in a very generic way, which is you don't punish countries by refusing to talk to them. Ronald Reagan talked to the Soviet Union, even as he called them the evil empire and so forth. It was a very generic question. Hillary Clinton, you know, I mean, you really see the skill, and it kind of reminded me of when George Bush turned that perfectly reasonable answer by John Kerry about legitimacy and using force into the global permission slip. And, you know, Clinton just really twisted the knife to say, well, it's, you know, it's naive to say you'll meet with leaders if you haven't already worked out the deal and you know, otherwise you'll be used for propaganda purposes. And this is really heated up. What's interesting, though, is, like, you could answer the question by breaking those down, right? You could treat each of those countries' leaders as individuals, and they're obviously different conditions you'd attach to each one. Like, there's no reason not to meet with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, right? I mean, he's a legitimately elected president. He's not at war with, you know, we disagree with him on a lot of things, but there's no reason not to meet with him. There would be every reason not to say, okay, Kim Jong-il, hop on a plane, come to Washington. Now, obviously, you wouldn't do that outside of a very carefully constructed deal, and you'd get something from it because it's something they would desperately want. What was interesting is that in building this up, Hillary Clinton's campaign has focused on Castro and Chavez in particular as people you wouldn't meet with, and Howard Wolfson, Clinton's spokesman, yesterday said, which Barack Obama would meet with Ahmadinejad. Who's a Holocaust denier, right, as if that was his main, you know, his main affair. And you could see them, you know, pushing the constituency politics button with the, you know, South Florida Cubans over here and Jews over here. And meanwhile, the one person you actually really shouldn't meet with, Kim Jong-il, they don't really care about. So it's sort of cynical.
Well, it does seem to me that I think this is such a mistaken view, but it does seem that Democrats, in order to prove their foreign policy bona fides, they feel like they've got to, you know, being tough is, and maybe Hillary in particular, you know, has this that is low to bear, that to really be tough on foreign, but you have to sort of assert that, you know, you aren't this, you know, pushover who's going to show up anytime, anywhere for a meeting. And it's unfortunate that these issues and all their complexities and all their nuances get boiled down to something as kind of idiotic as, you know, would you have a meeting with them? And then all that's supposed to imply about Hillary, right, or Obama.
Right. And I thought about, you know, I saw the thing, you know, Obama's now turning around and hitting really hard and calling this Bush-Cheney light.
Right.
And, you know, in a sense, that's probably, I think that's probably fair. I mean, there are a lot of themes in common between that.
He's accusing Hillary of being Bush light.
He's accusing Hillary of being Bush.
Right, and I think he was trying to clarify today his position by saying, well, of course he wouldn't just call them up and say come over for tea, but
right,
you know, there'd be some
And I don't think his answer, I mean, his answer was a generic statement about talking to people even though you disagree with them. I don't think he's changing his position.
No.
You know, you could answer that, as I say, you could answer that question in a number of different ways. You could state the general principle of you talk to your enemies, or you could actually, like, run through the list. And he chose to state the general principle.
Is it your view that these are distinctions with real differences? Is it your real view that Hillary and Obama have substantive differences in how they would approach dealing with Iran, for example? Because that's not my impression.
No, I don't think so. And there's very little else that has that has suggested that. I mean, they both have operated within very much the traditional. You know, the only one who had, you know, I mean, John Edwards answered in a previous debate. Only John Edwards answered a question about Iran really thoughtfully, in a way that suggested that he understood that there are multiple bases of power in Iran.
Right, right.
Which is like the key thing to understand about Iran, right?
Right.
I mean, you know more about it than I do. It's the one thing I understand about Iran. And both Obama and Clinton, you know, operated with the basic, you know, it's a rogue regime framework.
Right. I'm just trying to think about on the GOP side. Was it Chuck Hagel who also think in a similar debate setting, he was one of the few who sort of understood the nuances of that, and I think was...
Well, Hagel's not in the race, so he hasn't been participating in debates.
Well, I thought, okay.
I think he does understand it.
I think maybe it was on Meet the Press then that he was questioned about Iran, and he was.
I think it was.
And it was in the context of talking about whether he and Bloomberg would join up together to be this wild card team in the race. Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, he on the GOP side has shown some at least understanding about that the military option in particular is not the one that we ought to be pursuing, unlike Lieberman and...
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Last night I watched this tape that Max Blumenthal from The Nation, you know, who does these video pieces, did. He went to this organization called Christians United for Israel, which is run by a Texas televangelist. Mm-hmm. And Lieberman gave this speech of, you know, only you understand that we need to take a military action against Iran right now to preserve Israel. And then, of course, he went around with a camera to all the people who'd come to this conference who basically believed that Jews were going to hell. but they're all for defending Israel by bombing Iran. It's a very strange, very scary piece of video to watch. But, among the actual Republican candidates for president, there's no daylight on that issue.
Right, there's no daylight, right. That would provide the sort of strange bedfellows between Christian conservatives and another group would provide a transition to one topic. But I think we wanted to talk about Michael Kinsley's piece in Time.
Right, and also, you know, and some of those issues about taxes and inequality that also play out in the presidential election. So Michael Kinsley had a piece attacking, you know, really fiercely, talking about the tax loophole under which private equity firms and hedge funds, and I guess this is slightly different between private equity firms and hedge funds, you know, basically take all the money they take in, they're finding a way to pay at a 15% tax rate because it's treated as capital gains. And this is one thing that people have really focused on, and I think it's one thing that may pass, and they may actually act on this year to treat that fairly. Basically, what happens is if you're a private equity firm or a hedge fund, I mean, you're taking in all this money from other investors, and then you're agreeing to your payment is based on the gains. So you invest $1 million in my hedge fund. I think I understand this better in the hedge fund context. So you invest $1 million in my hedge fund. I agree to be paid 2% of all the money that I have under management, plus 20% of any gains.
Right.
So it looks like a capital gain, but it's not my cap. It's not like I put my money at risk. I put your money at risk, and I don't lose anything if I lose it, but I gain it if I gain it, and you've basically agreed to pay it to me as a fee. So it should be just regular income, which I would pay, you know, I'd be a gazillionaire, so I'd pay at the 33% rate, or higher. And they may turn around and fix this. I actually don't like the politics of this, because I don't like the idea of saying, oh, it's only those, you know, it's those hedge fund guys who happen to be, you know, ultra gazillionaires. I mean, the fact is, there's no reason we should have any different treatment of capital gains income and income that people get from work. And if two people are, you know, if you've got two people and one of them is making $80,000 sitting on his butt watching TV while he collects, you know, money from his grandmother's stocks, and another person is working hard and making $80,000, they should pay the same taxes. The one who's not working actually would pay much lower taxes right now. And there's no reason, you know, we have enough capital in the economy. It's not like we need this tax break to stimulate investment. There's money all over the place. That's why you wind up with these huge private equity firms, is there's money desperately searching places to invest.
Well, so, okay, well, just because I'm a novice in this area, but I just want to separate out a couple things to understand, and maybe viewers are also kind of, you know, there's the issue about capital gains and the tax rate, and I can hear my mother-in-law now, who, if she listens to this, would just start to, like, break out into a cold sweat, because, you know, she would think, and, you know, working middle class, upper middle class people who have worked really hard all their lives, saved their money, put it into the stock market, are trying to live off that, you know, if they can live off some of that income, you know, really right. dislike the idea of capital gains being taxed at the regular rate of income. But what these guys were trying to do, I think, was even trickier than that, right? And I'm looking at the piece that Kinsley wrote, and I'm trying to find the section in it that basically describes how they pay. There was sort of some sleight of hand where they were calling it capital gains, but then on their taxes, it was anyway. Well, I'll try to find it.
I think there's like three different moving pieces here. There's this one thing called retained interest, which I don't understand, and then there's the basic compensation. There's three different moving pieces, but basically they're pushing all this stuff into a special tax treatment, which if we didn't have all these games, if we weren't trying to play all these games in our tax system where we treated investment income differently, you wouldn't even create these opportunities for gamesmanship.
Right. I think Kinsley's really funny in this piece. He describes these guys as pigs, and I like the way he points out, this of course would never occur to me, they are fools who, in search of dignity, gave their gangs ludicrous Savile Row names, like the Blackstone Group and the Carlyle Group.
Right.
And I'm like, gee, it's sort of as a way of cleansing their money, giving money away to charitable institutions. But... Right. Yeah, well,
and yet some of us depend on those charitable institutions.
Exactly. And I think that there are lots of middle class people who would loathe the idea of taxes on capital gains changing. But here it's...
You mean loathe the idea of them going up to the normal rate?
Yes, exactly. Right. Well. Right. And first of all, it would be a big disincentive for people to invest in mutual funds because they would see some of their gains, their potential gains slipping away. I mean, I think that would have a big impact on the economy. But what I think I'm getting to the place where he explains the sort of accounting sleight of hand. I hope the lawyer or accountant who figured out how Blackstone could call some of its income a capital gain while calculating its taxes and then relabel the same pile of dough as ordinary income when computing its deductions, as reported last week in the New York Times, got a big, big bonus. I think that's where it's this issue about capital gains and then relabeling it or reclassifying it when computing deductions on taxes. That's the trick.
That takes it to another level of gamesmanship. That sounds like a classic David K. Johnston story in the New York Times where he discovers these things. I mean, people get paid, you know, somebody tried to patent one of these techniques of tax avoidance at one point, and he really gets to those. But I mean, I think the more we get lost in the minutia of how somebody played that game, the more we get away from the basic fact that you know, we need to create a tax system that doesn't create those incentives. And Edwards put out a tax plan yesterday that basically did all that and put the capital gains rate at 28% and created an exemption for the first, I think, $250 in investment income, which is, you know, it's great. If you ever do your taxes by hand and you have like $150 in capital gains, which is what I typically have, you know, actually figuring that out, on the computer it's not too bad, but it's really the biggest source of complexity in the whole system, because some of them are treated at different levels and everything else, and it's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, we leave all that up to TurboTax in our house.
Yeah, I've moved towards leaving it up to TurboTax, but I used to like to.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to like speak, but I just think there are a lot of middle class people, retirees, for example, who have more than $150 in capital gains, but less than $100 million. who don't want to see that taxed at a...
Well, sure they don't. But you know, I mean, I work for a living, and I don't want to see my money taxed either. I mean, when Warren Buffett puts it really well when he says that, when he points out that his secretary pays tax at a lower rate. Not a lower rate. His secretary pays tax at half the rate that he does. Because his income comes from capital gains and dividends. And that's just...
Oh, he's saying his secretary pays taxes at twice the rate.
His secretary pays on her income, which is all labor income.
Mm-hmm.
She pays at... I think she makes $85,000, something like that. She pays... Her marginal rate, her top rate, is twice Warren Buffett's rate.
Right.
Because his income comes in a different form. That's a ridiculous phenomenon, and Warren Buffett knows it, and you know, and half these hedge fund guys know.
So maybe
it's completely ridiculous. And I don't begrudge anybody their income. I don't begrudge retirees their capital gains income and so forth. I don't begrudge people who work. You know,
I just think $200,000 sort of setting the level at some reasonable. To me, finding the place, the Pareto optimal, if I can remember that term from economics. Where you get those guys with the ginormous capital gains, you've got to set it someplace where it isn't going to capture ordinary middle class people with significant investment, with maybe $100,000 in investment income. That, you know, I'm talking about people with, you know, well over a few million in investment income. It seems to me like it's got to be still somewhere out there, not where it's going to get.
I hate that politics of who's rich. You know, there was a great article, I think it was in Roll Call or The Hill last week, where the Democrats in Congress are kind of like bidding up who's actually considered rich. So a few years ago it was 200,000, you know, John Kerry would say raise taxes on people over 200,000.
Right.
That's kind of where John Edwards is. And then Chuck Schumer says it's 400,000. Nancy Pelosi says it's 500,000.
Really?
Is rich. Well, yeah, if you're in the Bay Area, 500,000 doesn't go that far.
If you're in Manhattan, 500,000.
You know, you're in Manhattan, right. I mean, look, I'm an exile from Brooklyn. We couldn't live in Brooklyn because we didn't have the income. I understand it. I don't. You know, once you get into that game, the numbers get bid up all the way. As far as I'm concerned, we need to be just clear as day. I'd love, you know, any Democrat who can be clear as day about saying anybody who makes $100,000 should pay the same tax rate as anybody else who makes $100,000.
So, wait, $100,000 in your book is $100,000 rich or not rich?
It doesn't have anything to do with whether it's rich or not rich. It doesn't have anything to do with whether it's rich or not.
So a person who makes $100,000 should pay the same tax rate
as another person who makes $100,000.
Oh, okay. That's reason. Yeah.
So if you're making $100,000 and it all comes from capital gains, and I'm making $100,000 because I'm working, I don't. It doesn't have to be less. It doesn't have to be more. It should be the same.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I agree with that. But I'm not enough of an economist to understand. This is not what my strength. But still, my gut.
No, but
tells
it's interesting
me.
because I mean this is kind of. I guess I'm sort of focus group testing what I think is a good Democratic message. I never understand why they do it, and I think the answer is when they focus group test it, they get a reaction like yours.
Yeah, no, because I really see these issues through the prism of my dad, who was a public school teacher, who was a small business owner for a while, who has money at Fidelity, goes every day, you know, sees what's happening. And it's not a huge pile. It's small. It's very medium, small pile. And I know that, you know, these, like, people don't tax his capital gains. It's not a lot of money, but it's what he has. I mean, I also think that people who take their money and invest it in the market, they've already been taxed on it because, after all, it's earned income, right? I'm talking about ordinary working people like my dad and my in-laws. They take their money that they earn, and then they put some of it in a 401k, and then if they're really careful, they save it in other ways. So they've already been taxed on that money, they're thinking. And then their stock goes up, they got lucky. So to tax it again, it feels like a double tax. But like
right. that's the line. That's the Wall Street Journal editorial page line for years and years. That's sort of gotten in the water. And it's, you know, they're not double taxed on the basis. You know, you buy a stock for $100, you're not taxed on the basis. You're only taxed on the gains. I don't.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Anyway, yeah. I still think that the
this
that
is good.
The,
you know, we were worried about having not having anything to disagree about.
I know.
The last one of these
well,
I did.
I wish I could be sharper ever. in my disagreement with you, because I'm sure that, you know, someone who really knew these financial issues better could articulate better. But my gut instinct tells me that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates have it absolutely right. But But the place you draw the line about taxing capital gains at a higher rate, it's got to be further down the ball field so that it doesn't impact, people like my dad, my in-laws, myself, when I, finish working at my meager, for whatever, we scrape together for our retirement. Whatever. That's where it is.
Okay.
We wanted to talk about a couple other things before, I know we're going to run out of time in a few minutes.
We
wanted to talk about Turkey, and we wanted to make fun of Bob and Mickey for their really kind of, I don't want to say pathetic discussion of Harry Potter and the Sopranos, but it was pretty pathetic. So do you want to talk about Turkey real quick?
Well, yeah, and you also had found this fascinating article about
bikinis.
the Islamic bathing suits,
yeah.
Which kind of got me thinking about that. No, I mean, as I said, one of the few foreign countries I know anything about is Turkey, because I've been there a couple times, and you raised the issue about the Islamic bathing suit,
right,
as a feminist, how you had to think about,
right,
about how women dress. And of course, when I was in Turkey a few years ago, it was all the outrage is actually, I met a group of women professors there who were basically, pulled me aside and said, "You Americans need to understand what's happening here. Women are wearing scarves in our classes, and do you understand what that means?"
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as an American, your idea of liberty is,
wear whatever the heck you want.
You wear whatever you want. You wear a halter top, whatever. You wear whatever you want,
right,
in class. It's not an indication of your, what you accept as liberal values are in a sense completely turned on their head in Turkey, and now they're having to deal with the fact that the moderate Islamic party has won the last election. The president will quite likely be somebody whose wife wears a scarf, and the military is going to need to deal with it. I mean, it seems like it's a really huge transformation,
right,
in Turkey. And I can't help feel kind of largely to the good, like kind of getting over this really strange world they lived in, where liberalism was defined by, what Kemal Atatürk said 70 years ago.
Well, Turkey has had this real sort of struggle, this real kind of deeply felt tension between the secular and the religious, and its constitution, of course, really makes clear that the religious is not can't penetrate the political, the secular. And so I think that that's a good thing, because we of course studied U.S. history, and that was sort of the foundation of our own democratic experience. So you're suggesting that you think this sort of shift is better because it will lead to more openness and tolerance, or why? Why do you think it's a good thing?
Well, I think they're still bound by that constitution, partly because they are a religiously homogenous country, unlike the United States, it's particularly threatening. It's particularly complicated for them. But they push religion so much. They're sort of aggressive. Their constitution really pushes it out of the public square. And the fact that the military would feel that it has the right to intervene if they feel like religion has entered too deeply into the public space, in the form of a president whose wife wears a scarf, for example, it is very different from our own, even the most liberal vision of what our own should be. But partly that's because we're a religious, we're a pluralistic country. So,
I'm made profoundly uncomfortable by, outward expressions of religion in public life. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's the water that I drank in New England growing up. But it's interesting, there's been a spate of articles about these new vacation resorts in Turkey, for example, that don't serve alcohol, where bathing is segregated. Mm-hmm. And
right,
these sort of, affluent Turks on vacation, now feel comfortable, religious Turks feel comfortable going to these places. And I saw this piece about bathing suit designers, one in Australia, one in the United States, who'd made Islamically appropriate bathing suits, one of them being worn in the photo in the magazine, Time magazine, by a woman lifeguard on an Australian beach. And at first I thought, oh, this is, you know, how neat, because these bathing suits, of course, have caught on, and, you know, burn victims and people who have great sun sensitivity and just feel uncomfortable about their bodies, they're buying these bathing suits. So there's a wider market for them than just women, you know. But so
beyond Land's End.
Yes, right. Beyond Land's End, right. Which, and I have not bought a Land's End bathing suit yet. I just want it stated for the record.
Okay.
It's in my future, probably, but I haven't bought one yet.
Reestablished for the record.
And so, you know, I'm thinking this is a good thing, and aren't these women smart and entrepreneurial? And then I'm because I'm the mother of daughters, I'm starting to feel this creeping sense of discomfort as I'm reading the article, and it ends on this note of, you know, freedom of choice. And that's like the point. That's what it's supposed to be. You know, and
right.
As feminists, we're all about choice, and you do your thing, wear what you want at the beach. That's great. But I'm just still really struggling with the notion on any level that the message to girls and young women should be that there should be some, any kind of feeling that they need to cover up their bodies for any reason, shame or modesty or whatever you want to call it. I'm just deeply uncomfortable with that. And so I think it puts women in a very difficult position, because of course you want to say to your Muslim sisters that that's great, that, you know, you want to cover your head. And I see girls here at the high school in Princeton who wear head scarves to class.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm still made very uncomfortable by it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
And why are you more uncomfortable with that than somebody who wears a cross around her neck or?
Well, because it's I don't wear a cross around my neck, but and I guess I wouldn't. I probably would not. But that's a smaller symbol of a religious devotion. That's it's less conspicuous,
right.
And it's
right.
And look, I'm not saying I'm right to feel this way, and I would never,
right.
I would never suggest. For example, in France, they've tried to outlaw headscarves in schools. I would never suggest that happen here. That's crazy. That's just a crazy imposition of the state on religious freedom. I would never, ever, ever support that. But I'm just saying, as a woman and as a parent, I'm very ambivalent about seeing it. And when I see it, I see it sort of more and more, it seems, in New York now. I'm just troubled. I just don't like the...
Yeah.
Especially the bathing suit thing. It's just, you know,
right.
Cover your body. I'm just very troubled by it. But, you know,
right.
That's my...
Right. But there are women... I mean, you know, I mean, I haven't... I mean, there are women in Islamic countries who write about this in
right.
different. There are different perspectives on it.
Absolutely,
I mean,
and there are lots of feminists who write,
yeah.
who are Muslim feminists who write and explain in very articulate, convincing ways
right.
why this is all about freedom for them, and
right.
I totally respect that. I just happen to disagree with it, and I'm not. I'd like to, you know, talk to some of those women maybe sometime,
right.
but I.
And how does it affect you as the mother of daughters? I mean, how do you think it?
Well, I just.
How do you, I mean, in an abstract sense, or
no,
do you
I
think
want
it
my
affects
daughter,
them?
My daughters wear bikini bathing suits. Sometimes they don't. But I want them to just not think. I don't want them to have to think. I don't want them to have to get the message that they look. They're going to anyway, because we all live in this world, and they read magazines and watch TV and get messages, of course, but I just don't like the message that their body is something to be covered up, to be embarrassed about, to be particularly modest about. I'm just not comfortable
right,
with that.
Right, idea. But they're not in that culture. I mean, in a sense, what they're getting is a message, you know. I think more so than I got growing. You know, I grew up in Connecticut. A message of what an enormously pluralistic world this is, and that
right.
there are families and people who have, you know, whose value systems are,
and that's
call
great.
For whole different
and,
things.
And they go to school with girls who are not allowed, for example, when it's summer, when it's hot, to wear capri pants. Their legs have to be covered to their ankles, and they have to wear long sleeves. And these are girls who are 9, 10, 11. And
right.
And so they absolutely I think appreciate that everyone's different and and that's those are choices that they've made for very good reasons, and that's you know,
yeah.
when you're in school, the objective is to really be focused on learning and being as smart as you can and all of that, and I love that. I'm very happy that my children go to school with you know, kids who are different from themselves.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's, I don't mean to belabor the point. I mean, I'm hoping that viewers who have feelings about this write and say how they view this issue.
Right. Yeah. No, it's an interesting. It's. I mean, I'm not saying I understand the discomfort, but I don't know how far you really.
Yeah, you
run
can't.
With
you
it.
Can't
I mean,
go very far
yeah.
with it. It's just yeah. like it's just. I just have to. I just sort of read these things and I make notes. It's great. Entrepreneur, bathing suits. Muslim women get to go to the beach and feel comfortable and can be with
right.
their families. That's wonderful. But then I privately, and now I've shared it publicly, think, oh, gee, you know, not my kind
right.
of, not what I would do, but whatever.
Right, well, definitely, right, definitely not what not, and not what I would do, not what I would do either.
So we have to talk just in our last few minutes, we're going to talk about Sopranos and Harry Potter, right?
Okay. With all, I mean, that was, because we talked about it before, and I thought, oh, I can't talk about it that much because I actually didn't watch much of the last
right.
of the Sopranos, and I haven't read Harry Potter, and we were supposed to talk about what Mickey and Bob talked about it, and I said I would watch that last night, so I went and watched it last night, and then I realized, they haven't done it either. They don't, you know,
yeah.
Bob's like, I don't get HBO, I don't read any books.
Right. Bob and Mickey tried
like,
to talk about the cultural zeitgeist without actually participating in it.
Right, exactly. And then they have a whole elaborate theory about violence and the Sopranos
yeah, right.
and so forth. It really
right.
is. It really
and
is.
Then Mickey it's just sort of condescendingly dismissed the whole Harry Potter phenomenon as the mediocre book. He picked it up once and put it down. And
right.
I just thought, like, the quintessential bachelor with no children in his life. Maybe he's
right.
got nieces or nephews. If he does, I hope that they educate their uncle.
Right. And are you a big Harry Potter fan?
You know, not particularly, but certainly
yeah.
I've lived with Harry Potter for the last,
yeah.
you know, 7 or 8 years. And we love, you know, my daughter and I are trading off reading the last book right now.
Yeah.
Great book. And you know, not to push back on Mickey, maybe he thinks it is mediocre literature, but, you know, I think what is so great about J.K. Rowling's books is that they treat children like smart children. They are, they're
right.
books written with this enormous, you know, well of imagination and creativity, a phenomenal
right.
breadth of creativity. And like many British writers, a long history, I think, of British writers for children, in children's
mm-hmm.
literature, you know, really don't dumb anything down for kids, really
right.
don't pander to them. And I think that's what kids understand when they're reading it on a certain level and you know, seize on it. And anyway, so I think her books are brilliant, and they're fun,
right.
and I can't wait to find out how it ends.
Well, it's also amazing to think about a book that, you know, that kids can go from, you know, you know, one of my daughter's friends who's younger than she is, so he's just starting kindergarten, is reading it, and, you know, all the way up to parents
absolutely.
Reading it, not just as children's literature. It's hard to think of another phenomenon that spreads quite, that's able to cover that kind of range. It's amazing.
Right.
It's staggering. My daughter has not gotten into it for some reason. She doesn't seem to be interested in it.
Well,
she's
your daughter, I think you said, is she only six?
She's six, but she reads. She reads, and she reads a lot. She reads on her own.
Yeah, well,
but, like, her favorite kind of book is like sports biographies from the mid '90s. You know, she like the San Antonio Spurs of the David Robinson
wow.
era.
How did, may I ask how she got interested in those?
Did her dad
have anything to do with that?
No. She says, oh, my dad got me really into sports. I'm like, you know, Claire, you are about 100 times more interested in sports than I am.
Wow.
It is in no way a projection of my interests. I think it's a way of sort of separating out from the. It's a way of I think of not getting sucked into the sort of the total girl world.
Yes.
Of the Barbies and,
right.
and all that stuff. It's a way of making sure you pull yourself out of it. I mean, she's interested in other stuff, too, and she reads these little mystery books. And, you know, for all I know, she'll turn around in 2 months and be a total Harry Potter
well,
fanatic.
Well, you know, I was just going to suggest that six,
that's
even
kids
when
are.
Kids are reading really fluidly at six, I think my children didn't really get into kind of independent reading, kind of, you know, gobbling up books until they were a little older. Even though they
yeah.
could read at six, it wasn't until sort of 9, 10 that I observed, especially in the case of my older daughter, that they're really kind of on their own charging forward and picking up all kinds of books. So it might happen a little later. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm sure read some things on her own. It's the greatest phenomenon when you wake up on a Sunday morning and realize, like, hey, she's in her bed reading to herself.
That's great.
I'm going back to sleep for another hour.
That is a great thing. I unfortunately wake up to the sounds of SpongeBob SquarePants mostly. But
yeah, that's all right, too. Or, you know, the problem with me is you wake up to the sounds, and then you sort of go half back to sleep, and then you have one of those songs stuck in your head all day.
That's brutal. And then The Sopranos, you know, Bob made the point, which is, I think, a really important point about glorifying violence and finding the human side in mobsters, and wouldn't it be good if David Chase could take his considerable creative talents and turn them onto another group in which it would be useful to find the human side? Obviously, I think thinking about terrorists, and Mickey pointed out that was done in the case of Syriana, a great movie. But I just wanted to defend David Chase to say that David Chase's expertise is the world of Italian Americans and the extent to which that relates to the mafia, and that's his world. That's what he grew up with, so that's what he knows. And I think he brilliantly depicted that in The Sopranos. And I think one of the reasons that maybe Americans could so be captured by The Sopranos is that it allows us a little bit to escape from scarier threats of violence that aren't relegated to kind of internecine clan warfare.
Right, right. No, I think the fascination, I mean, it's also, David Chase can write about that, but it's a long American narrative.
Right.
I mean, nobody who watches The Sopranos hasn't also watched, you know, The Godfather and Goodfellas and some of that tradition, as well as, you know, the other, in fact, the more humorous tradition, as well, you know, like Get Shorty or movies like that. I mean, it's working in a familiar field, although made it much deeper and more personal. I think it's the sense of the medieval code that governs violence, in contrast to the chaos and the uncertainty and the sheer viciousness and the slaughter of innocents that characterizes terrorism, and I don't think you could. I'm not sure you could just turn that around easily.
Right.
They're not the same. They're just such totally different things. And one is really. It is almost comforting to know that there are these kind of there's a world governed by these kinds of codes. Although I think in later Sopranos some of that really got lost. Although my watching of it has been spotty.
Yeah. Well, we don't get HBO, but. So we haven't seen the last season, but we've seen up to that. And I just think that it's the combination of the writing, the way it's filmed. I didn't have a problem with the ending when I read about the ending. You know, I think it's really brilliant, and it's also TV that doesn't pander. It's TV that's you know, smartly done, and that's rare on television now, certainly on mainstream television. So, for all those reasons, I think we need to get Bob and Mickey a DVD set. So they can. I talked to Bob's wife about The Sopranos, and she just isn't into violent stuff.
Yeah.
And I've tried to persuade her that the violence is presented in such a way that you can kind of get through it, a la Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. And it's not even that violent. Tarantino Pulp Fiction was much more violent, I think, than The Sopranos. But
right. Oh yeah, it was which Bob and Mickey talked about a lot,
right?
Too. I mean, it's hard to. That's a little different, and it was also sort of random, and that Pulp Fiction is a harder one to think about because it's very different from the rule-driven mafia context.
Right.
But it's, you know, that's a long time ago since I saw that movie. So
yeah. Well, on
I don't
that
know
note,
to say about that. All right. On that note, let's. Let's get on with our days.
Okay.
Fun to talk to you, Jackie.
Thanks very much.
And hopefully this won't get called the worst dive.
Okay, let's hope it's not the worst ever. Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.